Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Kleanna Lightbourne. Today, we'll have Luke Stoddard Nathan of the ALT join us to discuss local news.
Then, we'll be discussing the Next Epoch Seed Library with Nature Lab volunteer Ellie Irons.
Afterwards, we'll be joined by Barbara Smith of the Poor People's Campaign to discuss their 40 days of action.
And later on, we'll hear about last week's Unity bike ride from correspondent Dave Pablo. Let's start the show off with some headlines.
Tesla is cutting 9% of its workforce to reach what the CEO calls sustained profitability. CEO Elon Musk promises the company will become profitable in the second half of the year and won't need to raise money moving forward. Employees who are laid off will receive significant salary and stock vesting from the company.
President Trump pledged to cancel military exercises on the Korean Peninsula, surprising not only allies in South Korea, but also the Pentagon. American troops in Seoul said they are still moving ahead with a military exercise this fall, Ulchi Freedom Guardian, until they receive guidance otherwise through proper chain of command.
Spain offers to take in Aquarius ship carrying over 600 refugees. The ship has been drifting in the Mediterranean Sea with 629 refugees and migrants, including 123 unaccompanied minors, after Italy and Malta refused to let it dock.
Nexium, the colony-based organization alleged to be a cult, has suspended its operations while its founder, Keith Raniere, is on trial for sex trafficking charges. Raniere was brought back to New York and denied bail after fleeing to Mexico.
Rensselaer County District Judge Attorney Joel Abelove has been cleared of felony perjury charges by Columbia County Judge. The judge ruled that former Attorney General Eric Schneiderman was outside his jurisdiction when he accused Abelove of improperly handling the case of Edson Thevenin's death.
Former Guilderland Town Justice Richard Sherwood admitted Monday he stole more than $11.8 million from elderly clients, including one with dementia, in a real estate fraud that targeted money intended for charity. He faces a maximum of 10 years in prison. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's 105.3 Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, you can text us at 518-888-3004.
We're joined in the studio by Luke Stoddard Nathan from the ALT, here to fill us in. What's up in Troy?
And elsewhere. Thank you for having me. I guess we can start with the story that doesn't seem to die and is just seems people love to speculate out and opine on it and get mad about it or get happy about it in some instances. And that's, of course, the Gondola project. The Gondola, for people who don't know, a project team for a couple years now had its eye on stringing a ropeway between the Rensselaer train station and Albany. It would have gondolas passing kind of across the Hudson River to and from the train station. The trip would take about 5 minutes, and it would be running, you know, most of the day, I think about 16 hours a day, every day. The previous iteration that we sort of saw a couple, maybe half a year ago, it was going to have three stops. It was going to have a stop at the Rensselaer train station. It was going to have a stop kind of on South Pearl Street somewhere near there. And then it was going to have another stop at the Empire State Plaza. And in that iteration, the project team tried to get state funding through what's called the REDC Awards, or the Regional Economic Development Council Awards. It's sort of a state entity that with a volunteer board that makes selections on, you know, which sort of development projects get state funding, a subsidy. They were unsuccessful last year in trying to get that state funding. But this year they're trying again, and they've sort of scaled down the project a little bit. So instead of three stops, it has two. It'll have less towers kind of associated with it, and it's going to cost a lot less money. It was projected last year, in the previous iteration, was going to cost, I think, about $45 million, and it's decreased to about $20-something million now. So it's a scaled-down version of the project, but they still think it's going to be able to happen, or they're still hopeful that it's going to be going to be able to happen. They say that they want to privately fund about 80% of the project, so they're looking for about 20% in state or other sort of public subsidies to be able to make it work. And Eric, from what I understand from before we got on the air, you have some opinions about this project.
So yeah, referring purely to the original plan, I was not in favor. It did come across as A, prohibitively expensive, a little awkward to use, and not fully thought out when you really come down to it. I am interested to see what the new proposed stops are. I assume one would still, of course, be the Rensselaer train station.
Yes, maybe I didn't finish that thought. And the other one would be somewhere near the Albany Capital Center, the new convention center that was built recently. So it would just be those two stops. Although, you know, funny enough, I asked the guy who is the manager, sort of the managing person at the Capital Center, and he said he wasn't aware of any sort of negotiations about like locating a stop right there. So I'm still not, they were kind of, the guy who I talked to, who's behind the sort of executive director of the entity that's promoting this gondola, didn't want to specify exactly where. He just said near the Capital Center. So I guess you can use your imagination. So I think some of the details are still in flux. So it's hard to, you know, kind of definitively say like, oh, you know, it's hard for maybe the public to kind of be like, oh, I support this, I don't support this, without getting into more of the details of what exactly the project would entail, and, you know, and to what extent the public, you know, can or should subsidize it.
I'm curious if this company has built similar gondolas in other cities, or if any other cities have a project like this.
To my knowledge, it's not that common, if at all, in North America, at least in major cities. But I do know that one member of the project team is a Swiss sort of gondola company. Like, it's what they do, and they've built like thousands of gondola lines, but mostly, if not entirely, at ski slopes, you know. So
right.
So doing this sort of urban project has its own kind of complications, right? Because there's a lot of different like right of way kind of stuff and different approvals that you have to get. It's a sort of mosaic of different kinds of municipal and higher body kind of approvals that you need to be able to do a project like this. And I think to that end, in my story, I mentioned this. The entity behind it, Capital Gondola LLC, for those who want to know the official entity's name, they have entered into an MOU, or they're kind of in the process of updating an MOU, that Memorandum of Understanding, an agreement, basically, with the city of Albany and the city of Rensselaer, the two cities that basically says, let's all get behind this project. We know it's going to be very complicated to get. So if you guys are on the same page and you guys support this project, like, let's all try to work together to kind of make sure that it moves forward. And, you know, for what it's worth, the mayor of Albany is supportive of the project. And I also asked the county executives of each respective county, Rensselaer County and Albany County, and they are at least to some extent supportive of it as well. So
do they have an idea how much that grant might be worth?
I think they're asking for 20% of eligible project costs, and so you figure if the project cost is, you know, in the realm of $25 million, I don't know what's 20% of that. You know, like, I don't know, like a single-digit million-dollar subsidy. Mm-hmm. You know, perhaps is what they would ask. That's not necessarily what they will get. You know, they could get less than that. They could get nothing. You know, I guess it remains to be seen. I guess, you know, in terms, one more thing I think it's important to mention about the public subsidy kind of aspect of it is, like, you know, I've seen this point raised, and I think it's a valid one. Is, you know, if the public is going to subsidize this big flashy kind, are we overly enticed by these sort of big flashy transportation projects, when perhaps, you know, you could make the argument that money should instead go toward making a better kind of way for cyclists to just cross a bridge that's, you know, already between Albany and Rensselaer. Like, should we just give that money to CDTA and improve bus service, or, you know, revive a sort of shuttle line between Troy and there's trade-offs here that, mm-hmm. that are kind of interesting to think about. But, you know, that said, you know, it sounds like there's a significant amount of private money, you know, behind this gondola project. So is it worth, if we can subsidize it a little bit and then they'll take care of the rest, you know, is that something we want to do? Or does that come with, you know, drawbacks as well? So I don't know, a lot of interesting kind of questions that are somewhat a seemingly silly idea, like building a gondola between Rensselaer and Albany, kind of raises.
It does sort of call to mind that classic Simpsons episode where the whole town tries to build a monorail and they get sold on the idea. I worry that it might open Albany up to a little bit of mocking. a little bit there.
It already has, I think. But, you know, I asked the executive director, Tom Madison, who used to run the Thruway Authority, who's now behind, he's kind of the executive director of this project. And I asked him, you know, like, what's the public sentiment like? And he said that, you know, he was getting a lot more eye rolls a couple of years ago or a year ago than he is now. So maybe they feel like they're winning over hearts and minds slowly.
Certainly progress. So what's up in the area then?
O'Brien's Pub closed. You might know O'Brien's Pub. It's located on 3rd Street in the historic Trojan Hotel building. It was bought at a foreclosure auction, the building, in late December. And so now the new owners, it's kind of still on, they're not divulging a lot of details about their plans, but they've said in planning documents that they want to do some sort of boutique hotel, whatever that phrase means, you know, is kind of sort of still kind of unclear, I guess, but, you know, something with a restaurant and like they'll have a full hotel with all the floors, you know, because the building is historic, but I think the upper floors in particular are still somewhat, they need some serious kind of renovations. But anyway, without much explanation last week, the O'Brien's Pub closed, and, I had to actually go to the hotel, and I saw the owner the next day or the day after I heard this in the window, and I sort of waved, and she came out and she sort of explained that we were closing, but she didn't want to go into any sort of specifics about why she was closing, but she did say, that it wasn't because the business was a failure. And I put that in the story, but besides that, whether there was any sort of, you know, tension between the new owners and this kind of this bar, I don't know. I asked about that. The owner didn't want to get into it. And I asked the new owners, you know, did you ask O'Brien's Pub to leave this building? And they said, we didn't ask her to leave, but they were sort of, it was sort of a curt email exchange that I had with the new owners. So I don't really know all the specifics of what's going on, but it does seem like that property is sort of kind of going to be something new, you know, fairly soon. You know, okay. I should say, you know, that it will probably require a significant amount of money to rehabilitate that entire building. Mm-hmm. So that could take some time, but something to watch.
Isn't the Troy Farmers Market eyeing some new property too?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting story. And actually, I should credit WOOC because Liz Comitale, the market manager of the Troy Farmers Market, actually said on this air. Yesterday that they were, yes, the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market, which as listeners may or may not know, kind of alternates between being in the Troy Atrium during the colder months of the year and then being in the in Monument Square during the warmer months of the year on Saturdays. They want to be located in a permanent space in One Monument Square. Next week, the city is hosting like design charrettes about what should happen with that space. So kind of a week in advance of that, the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market is saying, hey, supporters, like if you like the Troy Farmers Market, you should go to those meetings next week and kind of advocate for us getting a permanent space in whatever, you know, however the city decides to move forward on that. We want to be there. So.
Well, excellent. We are almost out of time. Luke, can you give our listeners a good idea where they can find your articles?
TheAlt.com anytime. And as I always say on the air, I'm always open for tips. Feel free to reach out. I'm Luke@TheAlt.com. And thank you both for having me once again.
Thank you for joining us. That was Luke Stoddard Nathan of The Alt. As he said, you can catch him on TheAlt.com. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM.
The Poor People's Campaign, a national call for Moral Revival, is in the middle of their 40 days of action. The Moral Revival is the launch of a massive movement to address poverty, racism, militarism, and ecological devastation. The campaign is made up of protests, teach-ins, and art events. Albany has been the epicenter of the New York State Nonviolent Direct Actions. This week is week 5 of the campaign. We are joined today by a member of New York State Coordinating Committee for Poor People's Campaign. Barbara Smith is a Black feminist author and longtime activist who lives in Albany. Thank you for joining us in the studio today, Barbara.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, how are you?
Thank you.
So just to recap, what is the Poor People's Campaign?
Well, the Poor People's Campaign actually started 50 years ago with Martin Luther King. That was the last thing he was working on before he was assassinated. And he had started to bring together people in 67. And the plan was to have a Poor People's Campaign that would be national and would converge in Washington, D.C. in the spring of 68. And even though he was assassinated, that plan did indeed go forward. There was a tent city called Resurrection City, and people, while they were there, they lobbied their Congress people, their representatives. They also did civil disobedience. But because of his murder, the kind of energy and the vision of the campaign was difficult to fulfill. Not everyone who he worked with at the time understood why he was bringing white people and indigenous people and Latinx people together. And that was really unprecedented in the context of the civil rights struggle. Mm-hmm. Now, 50 years later, we are reigniting the Poor People's Campaign. It's not a commemoration or a celebration. We're reigniting that vision. And people are still poor. In fact, in many ways, poorer than they were in 1968.
And now the campaign for moral revival is in its fifth week. What does that mean for you, and what is the main focus going into this week?
Well, this week we focused upon the right to education, quality education, housing and homelessness, and also the right to organize in a union and to earn a living wage. So those are the issues that we focused on nationally this week, including here in Albany.
And so what is your level of involvement mean? Is there a lot of coordination between the national level and the state movement?
Absolutely there is. And there's a lot of coordination around the state of New York. It's a really interesting model because in every state, the focus is on having nonviolent moral fusion direct actions in state capitals. So every Monday for the last 5 weeks, except for Memorial Day when it was on Tuesday, every one of those weeks, there have been actions in those state capitals, 36 state capitals, plus Washington, D.C., and there has been civil disobedience where people risk arrest. And I believe around 2,000 people around the nation have already been arrested by now. We had 31 arrests yesterday in Albany.
I also heard that Albany is now fining members of the Poor People's Campaign. I saw a figure like $1,400 related to demonstrations that took place.
Yes, we did receive a bill from the city of Albany, and there's been quite a lot of discussion about that, particularly in the media, in the Times Union. There's a really wonderful editorial in the Times Union today talking about why would you be billing poor people for coming to protest about being poor and all the situations that arise from that and all the challenges that arise from that. But I don't want to really dwell on that. I think it's much more important to talk about our mobilizing people of all backgrounds all around the nation to say no to racism and poverty, militarism, and also to environmental devastation. Those are the four major focuses of the Poor People's Campaign, and we also look at how they intersect with each other. So if you're talking about environmental devastation, for example, it disproportionately affects poor communities and communities of color.
And we certainly see plenty of that in the history of New York State in terms of the way companies dump chemicals into the water and just designate the worst neighborhoods for the factories. What does the local base look like? How do you organize in terms of getting people to come to these events?
Well, that's always a challenge for any organizer, isn't it? And we are doing as much as we possibly can to make sure that people know. This event that we're having this evening is one of the ways that we let people know about the work of the Poor People's Campaign. We have Truthful Tuesdays, or Teaching Tuesdays. I prefer Teaching Tuesdays. They switched kind of labeling in the middle, and I like the first one better. So we're having a Teaching Tuesday session this evening in which we talk about the themes of the week, but also we watch a live stream from Washington, D.C., of people who are presenting around those issues. We are not stopping at the end of the 40 days. This is a 40-day, six-week model, 40 days of nonviolent moral fusion, direct action, 6 weeks. And the 6 week will be this coming Monday. I certainly invite people to come and find us. You can find us on our Facebook page, our New York State Poor People's Campaign Facebook page, which lists events all over the state, and to continue to get involved, because even after the 40 days and the 6 weeks are over, that's just the beginning. This is the launch period of the campaign, by no means a culmination. There will be a major mobilization in Washington, D.C. on the 23rd of June.
Excellent. Kleena, do you have a question?
Yeah, so I wanted to kind of go back to the theme of the Truthful Tuesdays. Or did you like the Teaching
Tuesdays? I like teaching. Some people say Truth Bubble.
As we'll go with what you like, Tuesdays.
Yes, as we were discussing it, when I was saying, I really like Teaching Tuesdays better, and the person I was saying it to said, yeah, because who knows what the truth is anyway.
Very true. So this week's theme is Everybody's Got a Right to Live.
Yes.
Education, jobs, income, labor, housing, and the right to organize. Can you tell us more about Teaching Tuesdays and what is planned for this week's discussion?
Well, I was not a person who planned this. I did help to get some of the pieces aligned so that we could have such a discussion. But the model is popular education and political education that's very important to the Poor People's Campaign, mm-hmm. and that's happening all over the nation. And I don't know if you are aware that there is a model of people teaching each other and people teaching people, that it's not about going to some institution or a building, you know, that's known to put out knowledge like a school or college or university,
right.
but that even in our own neighborhoods and in our own communities, every one of us has something to share and knowledge to share. And that's what the model is for our Teaching Tuesdays. We come together, we talk about the themes. The first two, I did indeed organize the first two, and the first one, and probably the second one too, we talked about how the day's action the day before had gone. Mm-hmm. And people just kind of jump in where they are. But it's an informal setting for us to talk about the things that matter most to us.
Great.
And how does nonviolence as both a method and a philosophy factor into the Poor People's Campaign?
Well, this is a nonviolent movement. And when people participate in our weekly actions, which have primarily been at the Capitol, we were elsewhere yesterday, but we were near the Capitol. And when people come for that training, we sign a pledge saying that we are committed to being nonviolent, at least for the space of the action. You are not taking a pledge for every other day of your life or every other minute or hour of your life. But in the context of us doing these actions every week, we are committed to nonviolence. Now, I come out of the civil rights movement. I was involved in the civil rights movement. That is the first one, or the original one, in the early 1960s. And I was trained in nonviolence at that time, and it definitely worked for me. So I don't have to really, you know, adjust anything in order to be involved in something that is a nonviolent movement. A lot of people don't understand that nonviolence is both strategically viable and that there's a long history of people changing things, including power relations, using nonviolence. Gandhi in India and Martin Luther King are the two most signal examples that we know of, that we hear of, but there are many people who have made that commitment.
And so we are running out of time. We know that you have to get out and actually do the event here at the Sanctuary. So for people who are interested in getting involved with the Poor People's Campaign, how can they reach out to you?
The most, I think, useful or effective way is to go to our Facebook page and see what the events are. You can click on events that you might be interested in, and then also to go to the National Poor People's Campaign website. If you sign up on that website, you will begin to get messages. And I know that we have an email address, but since I've never emailed it, I can't tell you what it is. But I bet if you go to our website, I'm sorry, if we go to our Facebook page, we'll probably find it. But as I said, I recommend that people go to both the New York State Poor People's Campaign Facebook page and to the National Poor People's Campaign website, and they will certainly get connected. And there are lots of nice videos on both of those sites. So you can see us what we were doing yesterday, making a chain, human chain, from the LOB to the Fort Orange Club and dropping hundreds of money bags along the way.
A very fitting symbol. Barbara Smith, thank you so much for joining us to talk about the Poor People's Campaign. We hope this event and the whole campaign goes very well.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
For those just tuning in, I'm Kleanna Lightborn.
And I'm Eric Newton. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Mohawk Hudson region.
Ellie Irons, a PhD student at RPI and volunteer at the Sanctuary's Nature Lab, spoke with WOOC correspondent Branda Miller about the Next Epoch Seed Library, an artist-run seed library focused on wild urban plants.
Ellie Irons, who is going to be our artist in residence this summer for an NEA grant as part of Nature Lab, North Troy Art Technology and Urban Research in Ecology, here in North Troy at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. The project, the whole grant, is called BioArt Futures and Our Forgotten Urban Ecologies. And Ellie is going to be working on her project, which is called Next Epoch Seed Library. Welcome, Ellie.
Hi,
and
Brenda.
Could you please tell us about the Next Epoch Seed Library?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the Seed Library is a project that I started in 2015 with a collaborator named Ann Prococo. Ann is based in Jersey City. I was based in Brooklyn at the time, although I'm now in Troy. And the two of us realized that we both had this interest in seed saving, and we'd come to it through artistic practice, which struck us as kind of a funny coincidence. And it was actually just during a casual studio visit that we thought, huh, well, maybe we should start kind of saving seeds a little more formally and start swapping them. And the basis of the seed library actually has to do with the kinds of seeds that Ann and I were interested in saving, which is seeds that most people would call weeds. We like to call them wild urban plants or spontaneous urban plants. These are the plants that do really well in landscapes that humans have impacted heavily, whether it's growing out of a sidewalk crack or growing in a Superfund site. They're plants that are survivors, and we think they have all sorts of benefits and are often overlooked.
I know that you offered a workshop where there was a seed exchange a few months ago, and it was extremely popular. Why are seeds important? Why do we need to be looking at them more now than ever?
Yeah, that was a really great event. I put that together with Azaray of Collard City Growers, and it was a really wide-ranging event in that we didn't just focus on wild urban plant seeds. To the contrary, it was things that people had harvested from their gardens and things that kind of home gardeners wanted to share with each other. Actually, everything in my garden this year is sprouted from the seed swap. Actually, I should say, last week everything was. I just added some stuff from the plant sale. So now it's a little bit of a mix. But seeds are key to food sovereignty. And the way that things have been shifting in terms of industrialized agriculture and corporate-run agriculture, we're running into this situation where there's actually getting closer and closer to being like a monopoly on seeds. I think it's, is it Bayer and Monsanto that are working on merging, right? And they actually control a huge range of seeds in the form of industrial agriculture, where these seeds are sold to people who are required to plant in a specific way and harvest in a specific way that feeds this kind of, I think, really disastrous relationship with food. So by saving our own seeds, we take back some of that control and we're actually able to understand the process from start to finish of feeding ourselves, which I think is revolutionary, even though it's something humans were doing up until just 100 years ago.
And by working with seeds, you're planting a seed for this very critical conversation about our future and remaining free of toxins and what we can do to make a difference in our community.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's funny because we work with wild urban plants, which people don't tend to associate with community health and resilience. But to us, the wild urban plants that live alongside us in cities are actually key to a healthy, livable city. I mean, certainly there's a few plants that, like poison ivy, humans have a hard time with, obviously. Ragweed, some people have a really bad allergic reaction to. But there's so many of these wild urban plants that are doing huge services to us. So they're helping capture and hold water in the soil. And in a city where we've got combined sewage overflow problems, that's hugely helpful. They actually capture and hold particulate matter, particularly those ones with large leaves. And so that means they can actually be reducing air pollution. In a situation where we've got asthma problems, you want to be around trees that are able to hold on to some of that particulate matter. Certainly, we hear a lot about the heat island effect in cities, like temperatures going up and actually getting hotter in cities. So we're having actual like deaths from heat, which is not something that was perhaps as common in the United States 30, 40 years ago. We've been, if we're able to kind of rewild and reforest our cities, we'll have less trouble dealing with that in the future potentially. And of course we could do that with the kinds of plants that might have been here 200 years ago, the native species 400 years ago. But unfortunately, because our climate is changing, some of these weedy plants that have come from other places, say like the Tree of Heaven, the ailanthus, or the princess tree, Paulownia, they're actually really well suited to the changing climate. They're pretty flexible. And as things get hotter in the future, we might find that they're better able to handle these challenges, which is kind of what the Next Epoch Seed Library is about, is shedding light on some of those future companion species.
Wow, so it's like really learning about climate change through action, through direct action.
Yeah.
And this summer, you're going to be doing this residency with youth who come to our Uptown Summer Program. It's the 8th annual Uptown Summer Program. This summer is going to be focusing on environmental justice and environmental stewardship leadership. And how will the Next Epoch Seed Library play into the Uptown Summer Program?
Sure. Yeah. So we're really looking forward to this. We've been doing a variety of programs, not just about, and we do collect, harvest, save, and share the seeds of wild urban plants through exhibitions and seed swaps, like you mentioned. We have a big educational component. But another part of what we do is trying to imagine seed pasts and futures. We're really fascinated by the fact that seeds can, in a way, time travel. So I don't know if you've heard some of these stories that have come out recently about seeds that are discovered in archaeological sites. So there was a 2,000-year-old seed discovered in what's now Israel by archaeologists about 10 years ago. It was a seed of a Jerusalem date palm, a kind of variety that's not around anymore, and it was actually sprouted. And that tree grew into a full-size tree and has now made baby trees. So it managed to keep a little germ of itself alive for 2,000 years and then sprout again. So we're really fascinated by that. I think it kind of awakens the imagination as to time spans bigger than ourselves and helps us think forward and backwards in terms of generations of people and plants. So one thing that we'll be working with the youth to do is create kind of a seed time capsule. We'll be putting kind of some hopes and wishes and aspirations and perhaps fears also about the future into a seed capsule along with seeds that are known for their longevity. And we'll be finding a place somewhere on the Nature Lab campus to inter this long term. Some of the things Anne and I have done in the past, we just did one earlier this spring where we're planning to dig the vessel up in 10 years and see if any of the seeds sprout. So it's kind of a promise to ourselves to continue this project and to keep thinking about these issues and to return and dig the seeds up and then bury them again. And with the invitation being for someone to dig them up 100 years from now. So imagining what will the landscape look like in 100 years? What do we hope for? What do we need to put in place now so that the kind of future we're burying these seeds for might exist?
Planting roots and hopes for resilience.
Yeah.
With the youth and with the community. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Do you have any last words you want to say about this project?
Let's see. What else could I tell you? Well, at the Seed Swap, actually, we did a little bit of work with a very contemporary just in the moment, rather than burying seeds for long term. This was about seed redistribution. I actually did a little urban ecology explainer about it a few months ago about this plant primrose that grows all over North and South Troy, but actually has had some lack of genetic diversity because in urban ecosystems, it's sometimes hard for plants to share genes because they're far away from each other across sidewalks and large infrastructure, big buildings. So we were encouraging people to take some evening primrose seeds from North Troy and place them in South Troy, and with the hopes that that would help the plants interbreed. And also because more diverse plants, it turns out, there was a scientific study that showed this, actually support more diverse insect habitat. And with our insects in decline, as you may have heard about recently, we need to do everything we can to provide them with a serviceable habitat.
If people want to get involved who are in the listening audience, how could they be involved?
Well, you can certainly check out our website, nextepochseedlibrary.com, and we've got a list of ways that you can kind of do some of this stuff yourself. We've got some curriculum. You can download activities. You can email us from there. There's a contact link if you want us to share seeds with you or if you have seeds to contribute to us. We take donations, and we also try to keep a list of upcoming events. So just check that out.
We look forward to watching the next epic seed library evolve in North Troy and beyond. Thank you so much for being here, Ellie.
Thanks, Brenda.
That was Ellie Irons speaking with WOOC correspondent Brenda Miller about the next Epoch Seed Library.
Time now for this week's segment on bicycling in Troy. WOOC correspondent Dave Pablo joined us up with the Thursday Unity Ride. Dave spliced together a collage of recordings from the ride, which started in Riverfront Park in Troy, made its way past a block party in Cohoes and up to Cohoes Falls, before heading back to Rare Form Brewery in downtown Troy. We begin with Unity Ride's main organizer.
So my name is Marissa Peck, and we're at Riverfront Park in downtown Troy, meeting to go on a Unity Ride, which is a now weekly community bike ride around Troy and the surrounding capital region. We ride as a group, and the goal is to make people feel comfortable riding on the roads and on bike paths, and to make cars more aware that there are cyclists in this community.
How long have you been doing that?
We started the project last summer. Well, we started it on a very cold spring day in April of 2017, and we were doing monthly rides last year, the third Thursday of every month, and sort of the same premise. We ride for about an hour, 10 miles, varying degrees of hills and routes, and we always ride a different route. We encourage people to choose the route or decide to be a ride leader for that week or that ride.
And what kind of response are you getting from motorists?
So far, we haven't had any sort of altercations. I think when people see a bunch of people riding a bike, like in a group, they seem to be a little bit more forgiving than some maybe solo cyclists have encountered on the street. So there's power in numbers, for sure.
Have your routes taken you over any of the redone areas with the bike lanes?
Yeah, so last week was the first week that we rode with some of the new bike lane infrastructure. But since the start of the project last year, we always were riding the proposed bike route and bike paths. So we would always ride into South Troy sometimes even down and across the South Troy Bridge, because we knew that that's where the path was going to be slated to be built in the following year. And then up the Uncle Sam Trail into North Troy and North Central, just to get people familiar with the route and to let them know that this bike path would be coming in the coming years.
I'm tempted to ask you about, you know, is the next step critical mass?
That was something we always talked about. Like, what happens if it gets too big? You know, critical mass in New York City, or even this Unity Ride, we stole the concept or borrowed it from a group in Rochester. They shut down the streets in Rochester and do this ride once a week, and the police, like, escort, and they do the same route every week. That's certainly not our intention right now. But it would be super cool, even if once a year Troy had a couple thousand people out on the roads riding around the Capital Region together as a group, for sure.
And if people want to learn more about the Unity Ride and the schedule of it and everything like that, where can they go?
Yeah, so right now we're just posting it on Facebook, on Troy Bike Rescue's Facebook. And we're making Facebook events, but it's every Thursday throughout the summer. And we meet at Riverfront Park around 5:30. The ride leaves off around 6 p.m. And you should expect to be out for about an hour. And then we started also, if folks are interested afterward, going out for a beer, some food at Rare Form, and having sort of a decompression conversation, get to know you, and planning meeting to see where else we might want to go next.
Okay, so I'm speaking with one of the other riders on the Unity Ride. Tell me who you are.
I'm Tracy Husson, and I love to bike, but sometimes it's hard to find the motivation. So for me, knowing that there will be other people here is a good incentive to come to it and actually come out and bike.
Nicely. If you're riding behind somebody, try not to get so close to them that your wheels cross, because that could get hairy if someone stops or swerves because of a pothole. And just try to point out if there's like glass in the road or potholes or debris or things that the person behind you should know about. You can just point. If you hear me say car back, it means that there's a car coming and we should all just sort of file into a single file line if we're not, but we should really be trying to ride single file for the most part until we get on a bike path. Any questions?
Kind of
we'll tell you if you're going too fast. Okay. This isn't a race. We all just kind of ride comfortably.
Yeah, I was thinking we'll head out.
Oh yeah, you're the ride leader. It's all you, all man.
Right.
It's on you.
You're
we'll
in
follow the normal streets until we get over to the main bike path, and then. So this is one of the paths in Coase. There's, I guess, now like four or five different paths you can take. There's one down along the Hudson, which we came up on. We crossed over to this. There's another one even further up the hill, and that follows the old Erie Canal footpath.
How's everybody feeling?
Really good.
Yeah.
Yay, ride.
Perfect night for this.
We navigated that like busy part well.
So I don't know. I guess I misspoke earlier. The path we came along was the old Erie Canal footpath. And if you saw those foundations or whatever on the right, Those were the old locks.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. There. So you have lock one, which is down in Troy. Then you have lock two, which is in Waterford. And then you have whatever the last lock is out in Buffalo area along the Erie Canal, the new Erie Canal. And so.
Should we ride home?
Now I'm not sure.
The falls were really pretty. Mm-hmm. And I never biked on that path.
It was neat.
Yeah,
it's good ride.
It was there.
So where did you actually go?
We went across the Green Island Bridge, and then we went on the railroad road.
The Black Bridge is right? Yeah.
I think so. And then we went over into Cohoes.
That's Ontario Street, which is like the top of the hill there.
Yep.
And then there's, that's where you can pick up one of the little trails. It's just a little cut through that one.
It looks like someone's driveway.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then you pass one of the old blocks of the canal. Like the foundation structure.
Up by the loft apartments.
Yeah, those beautiful apartments we've been talking about. And then down to the falls, and then we took, we went back through Lansingburg on the Troy side of the river.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's
something. That was an impromptu decision.
That was correspondent Dave Pueblo with a recording from last week's Unity Ride in Troy. The ride happens every Thursday throughout the summer, meeting at 5:30 p.m. in Riverfront Park and leaving at 6.
For many cooperative businesses and alternative entrepreneurs, finding the financing to grow can be a major pain, especially for those in the food business. Correspondent Mark Russo attended the Slow Living Conference in Brattleboro to learn how others in our region are tackling this issue. While there, he sat down with two leaders in the field of alternative finance, Raymond Lanza Weil of the Vermont Community Land Fund and Maggie Kahn of the Cooperative Fund of New England.
Hi, this is Mark Russo, and I'm joined today by Raymond Lanza Weil and Maggie Kahn. We're here to talk about community development loans and cooperative businesses. Raymond and Maggie, thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark. Nice to be here.
So let's just start. If you could both introduce yourselves and the organizations that you work with. Maggie, let's go to you first.
I am a loan officer for the Cooperative Fund of New England. We are a community development finance institution, a CDFI. And we lend across New England and into New York State. We lend to cooperatives, occasionally to nonprofits, but our mission is to build and sustain the cooperative economy. So our borrowers include food co-ops, worker co-ops, housing co-ops, fishing co-ops, any entity that is democratically controlled, and the nonprofits that we have funded sort of tie into the same basic, I guess what you could call alternative economy, supporting affordable housing and job creation in low-income communities.
And I'm Raymond Lanza Weil, the Director of Business Programs at the Vermont Community Loan Fund, or VCLF. VCLF is a 30-year-old nonprofit organization based in Montpelier that operates statewide. We have two main lines of business. We make loans to affordable housing developers, and we make loans to businesses that can't get bank financing or all the financing they need from a bank. We make loans, and we provide ongoing business advisory services to our borrowers, and that's the main thing we do. Our mission is to improve the lives and the vitality of Vermonters and Vermont communities.
To a layperson, what are the key differences in the ways that your organization lends money compared to more traditional business institutions like a bank?
At VCLF, we are able to take more risk and offer more flexibility than a bank. Banks tend to lend inside of a box that has bold lines around it. We have a lending box as well, but our box has blurrier lines. Sometimes we go outside the lines. We like to color outside the lines. So when we have a business that doesn't qualify for a bank loan, either because of their stage of business or their collateral, or maybe a recent history of not having enough profits, we look for ways to mitigate the risk that's created by those, what the bank sees as deficiencies. What the bank sees as deficiencies, we see as opportunities. A big key to lending for any institution is belief in management's ability to execute a plan. And we tend to spend a lot of trying to understand management as much as we try to understand cash flow and collateral and the other things that go into any lending decision.
Sounds like you look for additional character relationship in addition to the bottom line.
Absolutely. And I think, again, any lender looks at character as a component. We probably place more emphasis on that. And we're looking for people who are who want to grow their business and who are willing to get some help with that, who are coachable, if you will. We don't have a test for that, but that's certainly one of the things that distinguishes us from a traditional lender.
And I would add that I think that's true of most CDFIs. It's certainly true of the Cooperative Fund of New England, also CFNE. And, you know, CFNE came into being in 1975 because traditional lenders would not lend to co-ops because they really don't understand the ownership structure. We started lending to food co-ops that wanted to open storefronts, and the bank would want the owner to co-sign the loan, and the food co-op would have 300 or 1,000 owners, and it just didn't work. So CFNE came into being and then expanded to lending to other kinds of co-ops. And I would say, I would absolutely agree with Raymond, the character of the borrower is really critical. And building a trust relationship between us as the lender and the co-op as the borrower is really key, because the more open the borrower is willing to be with us, the more able we are to sort of help them identify issues and overcome problems and come up with solutions before things reach a critical and sometimes fatal stage, right? And often people are not willing to talk to banks openly, with good reason, because banks they'll shut you down, they'll foreclose. Banks, to be fair, are very strictly regulated by the government. And some of our flexibility comes from being subject to different regulations as a CDFI.
So speaking of CDFIs, this is a bit of alphabet soup that I'm just learning about, because your organizations are CDFIs, your community development financial institutions, but there's also the Community Development Fund Institution Fund, which is a federal program which affects all of these community lending programs. Given the current political climate, what are your thoughts on the health of the CDFI as a federal source of funding?
The CDFI Fund is a part of the U.S. Treasury, and it was established during the Clinton administration, and it's been somewhat immune from political winds. The CDFI Fund enjoys bipartisan support because the CDFI Fund is investing in CDFIs, in community development, through these loan funds that are called CDFIs, and helping low-income and other distressed communities across the country. So as a result, most elected officials have supported the CDFI Fund over the years. The current administration, as other administrations, has tried to cut back on the CDFI Fund's funding, but Congress said no to that and kept it fully funded. The CDFI Fund of the Treasury does indeed make investments in, both in the form of grants and loans, in CDFIs across the country. There's over 1,000 organizations across the country that are designated as CDFIs. The majority of them are nonprofit organizations operating loan funds, but there's also credit unions, banks, and venture capital funds that are all designated as CDFIs, and all of them share a common mission of investing in low-income communities.
You touched on earlier the democratic nature of cooperative businesses, which is a contrast to the way that many conventional businesses are run, which are non-democratic. Can you speak to the benefits of cooperative and democratic business ownership for local communities and for the broader regional and national economy?
I'd be happy to do that. There are some privately held sole proprietorship businesses where employees can be very involved in decision making. Even with those, ultimate decision making always rests with the owner. When you have a business that is a cooperative, and some of the cooperatives that we work with, the worker co-ops, are businesses that have been sold by the owners to the workers. They do that, and this is relevant to your question, because when the workers own the company is going to stay in the community. The money that the company generates is going to stay in the community. Co-ops serve often very specific and important needs in communities, whether it's a retail service providing food, like a food co-op or a landscaping company. They hire local people, and they are not going to sell out to their competition. These companies are never going to pick up and move to the South or to Mexico or subcontract out their work to China or wherever, India, call centers, wherever. They're really based in the community because it's community people, and more than one of them, I would, by our definition, more than three of them, who own the company and who keep that money in the community. And the other thing is that what it is it's not just a decent job with a decent income. It's an opportunity for the owners to build wealth and really build a stake in the business and in their community.
And how? That seems like a great note to let you folks get back to the importance business you have to attend. But before I let you go, are there any, do you have any recommendations for any entrepreneurs or interested parties who might be listening to find resources about community loans in their area or any other cooperative resources available?
Well, I have a couple suggestions. One is certainly search on the internet for CDFIs in your area, but also, at least in Vermont, the Small Business Development Centers are a very robust network of advisors who are very familiar with all of the financing resources available in the state. I think every state has SBDCs, Small Business Development
Centers. We do in New York. There's an Albany SBDC.
Absolutely. And SBDCs can be a great resource for finding your financing options and for finding the other resources you might need for your business.
There is also a national association of CDFIs called the Opportunity Finance Network. And their website, which is ofn.org, I think, you can find listings of CDFIs in your area through that website. And I would also add, for people in Vermont who are interested in finding out more about cooperatives, the Vermont Employee Ownership Center is, I think, a pretty good resource. There is not a similar entity in New York State.
Unfortunately, in New York, for our leadership in many fields, cooperative business ownership, we are definitely lagging behind Vermont.
Many states are lagging behind Vermont, I would say.
Well, it's a blessing to have such a progressive neighbor. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Been a pleasure.
That was Raymond Lanzawile of the Vermont Community Land Fund and Maggie Cohn of the Cooperative Fund of New England. To learn more about funding for cooperatives in our area, visit www.coopfund.coop. And for information on CDFIs to invest in your business or community project, visit www.ofn.org. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Kleanna Lightborn. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have any comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.